For generations, the term socialist was considered a slur. This hour, why today many Democrats consider themselves democratic socialists. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What is a democratic socialist and why has it become popular? What's its appeal at this particular time in our history? A few of the questions we'll explore this hour with our guests, Laura Rodriguez and Lisa Lai, both Democratic Socialist leaders in Iowa. Also, political scientist Jeff Taylor of Dort College and University of Iowa historian Mike Smolik. What's your take on the appeal of Democratic Socialism? Join our conversation. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, for generations, at least when I grew up, the term socialist was considered a slur, a slam. Well, this hour, we want to explore why today many Democrats consider themselves democratic socialists. What is a democratic socialist anyway? Why has it become popular? And what's its appeal? What leads us to the appeal of democratic socialism at this particular time in history? We'll be looking at those questions this hour with a number of guests. Perhaps you would like to join our conversation as well. Do you consider yourself a democratic socialism? What democratic socialist? What is your view of democratic socialism? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. You can also email us, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Well, what prompted this conversation? You know, last Tuesday, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a 28-year-old Democratic Socialist, shook the Democratic Party by toppling Joseph Crowley, a 19-year incumbent, chair of the Queens County Democratic Party, the potential heir to the House Minority Leader, Nancy Pelosi. Think of this. Weeks before the election, Crowley's own polling showed him up by 36 percentage points. It ended by Ocasio-Cortez winning by 15 percentage points. Here's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on The Late Show last Friday telling host Stephen Colbert how she defines democratic socialism.
So for me, democratic socialism is about really the value for me is that I believe that in a modern, moral, and wealthy society, no person in America should be too poor to live. That's what I think.
That seems simple.
Seems pretty simple. So what that means to me is, healthcare as a human right. It means that every child, no matter where you are born, should have access to a college or trade school education if they so choose it. And, you know, I think that no person should be homeless if we can have public structures and public policy to allow for people to have homes and food and lead a dignified life in the United States.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, 28-year-old Democratic Socialist, shaking the political landscape here in the U.S. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Laura Rodriguez is with us. She's a Democratic Socialists of America Quad Cities chapter chair. I hope that's the right title. Laura, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about how you interpret democratic socialism. Would you agree or add anything to Ocasio-Cortez's definition there?
I think my girl summed it up perfectly.
Right. So tell us a little bit about your background. What drew you to democratic socialism?
I am living the nightmare under capitalism. I am a retail employee, okay? I was a stay-at-home mom for a long time. Somebody suffering under student loan debt and medical debt, just being completely swamped, felt like very limited in options as far as what to do with myself under this system. Like, where do I fit in, you know?
It sounds like you may find fault in the system rather than your choices.
Definitely take some personal accountability, 100%. In fact, however, it's hard to ignore the statistics for women of color and minorities in this country.
Mm-hmm. So was there a turning point, a moment when you said, I am definitely a democratic socialist? If so, what was that moment?
Oh, man. I want to say I can kind of trace it back to maybe Bernie Sanders. I could put it there when he defined what it is to him, at least. That resonated with me. And at the time, I lived in a very rural area during the election. And at the time, really only had one or two friends in the area. And the two girls that I got along with best identified as democratic socialists. And I didn't fully know, you know, what the details were. I just said, hey, you know,
even
what
the label meant, you didn't know?
At that point, I was probably willfully ignorant. I mean, I really considered myself a progressive at that point and really shied away from the term, maybe. I was surrounded by people that are more, you know, liberal.
Can you say now what you see as the difference between a democratic socialist and a progressive? Is it part of a continuum? Is this you got progressive slightly to the, I guess, right of the democratic socialist, or is it not that easy to?
I just keep moving left as I get older and see more things.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Laura Rodriguez is with us, the Democratic Socialists of America, Quad Cities chapter chair, 33 years old. I understand your dad's a veteran, your mom's an immigrant.
Heck yeah. Yeah, I'm proud of that.
Jeff Taylor is with us as well. He joins us from Dort College, in Sioux Center, off in northwest Iowa. Hi again, Jeff.
Good to be back with you, Ben.
Good to be back with you. So give us some context here. What are we talking about here when we talk about the appeal of democratic socialism and where it fits into our political landscape?
Well, you know, traditionally, I would say that socialism as a word, as an ideology, you know, as various parties in the United States, it's usually been a tough sell among Americans. When the various small socialist parties got underway in the late 1800s, a lot of the leadership, a lot of the candidates of those parties tended to be foreign-born immigrants from Germany and Russia and other places. And then as we moved into the 1910s and for about 40 years after World War II with the Cold War, socialism became identified with Marxism and then by extension with communism. And so there was a lot of resistance to the label of socialism among Americans. But at the same time, if we go back to the 1910s, there were a number of Americans, including rural states like Minnesota, North Dakota, Oklahoma, where the Socialist Party did quite well getting into the teens in running candidates for president. So I think on the one hand, there's kind of the doctrinaire Marxist type of socialism, but it's also kind of a catch-all label for people who are dissatisfied with capitalism, as Laura mentioned, that oftentimes it's seen as kind of a binary choice. If you don't like capitalism, well, what else is there? There's socialism. And so I think, understandably, there's a lot of people who have some criticisms and doubts of the capitalist system, and so oftentimes they'll end up in, if not embracing the label socialist, they'll at least understand of where people are coming from. And I think obviously the Sanders campaign in 2016 really brought that into the mainstream in a new way.
Mm-hmm. What in our news in the last few years, Jeff, would you say drove the popularity of democratic socialism right now? I mean, we can go back to the 2008, 2009, the Great Recession. Put a lot of people in the basement, right?
Yes. Yes, I think the idea that and you've kind of seen this in from 2008 on, kind of a growth in the Republican Party of kind of a libertarian impulse, more individualism. You see more of a socialist movement in the Democratic Party, but both of those are responding to what's often called crony capitalism, where this idea that big business, big banking, is in cahoots with big government, and it's bailing out, it's propping up, it's giving special favors to this corporate sector, and the individual, the small business owner, the consumer, are often kind of left out of this sort of cozy iron triangle that's taking place in Washington D.C. So I think the 2008 recession, the bailouts that occurred during that period, I think that drove a lot of people, not all into the socialist camp, but also into the libertarian camp. A lot of people who said the current system doesn't work. We need kind of a dramatic, radical break from the status quo.
So that's interesting. You put libertarians and democratic socialists, so they represent things that are quite different. They have something in common here.
I think so. I think kind of the Ron Paul, Rand Paul movement within the Republican Party, the Bernie Sanders movement, and now Ocasio-Cortez movement in the Democratic Party, they have a similar diagnosis that the political and economic system is broken. Now, the prescriptions that they come up with are very different from one another, but yes, I think there's some common ground there.
Okay. Join our discussion as we discuss democratic socialism, its appeal at this particular time in our political history. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Nick. Nick is calling from Des Moines. What's your view on democratic socialism, Nick?
Hello, thank you for taking my call. First, I think it's a really good synopsis that crony capitalism has kind of reached out and affected a lot of what I feel like millennials and a majority of people see. But a big question that I have is, whenever we look at socialism kind of in the past, and I'm being told as a millennial right now that Social Security will not be there, Medicaid will not be there due to its poor funding, but it seems this routine factor that socialism is a great ideal, yet in practice, 50, 60 years down the road, it consistently seems to break down. I think that's kind of the biggest question is, how does socialism get past this concept from idealism into a practice that is continued on thoroughly and doesn't experience those same recurring problems that you see in other countries and other socialist societies that have seen that failure as time goes on?
Mm-hmm. Nick, thanks for bringing that up from Des Moines. Laura Rodriguez, you've probably wrestled with that, looked at socialist ideas put into practice in other countries in the past, some of them not going so well. What is your answer to Nick's question about how socialism doesn't seem to work out when it's employed?
Socialism didn't work out because of U.S. intervention historically, right? If we are working on socialism, you know, state by state, all across the nation, are we going to interfere with ourselves? I don't even know how to.
Jeff, how would you answer that question?
Well, I think it's part of the issue here is that socialism, like other ideology names like conservatism or libertarianism, it's a broad term, right? So it could include anything from Marxist-Leninist communist regimes, either of the past or there's a handful left.
Very authoritarian regimes.
Exactly. So, you know, there's a totalitarian political dimension to that. But then you also have democratic socialism in countries Sweden and other Scandinavian countries, Britain, the United States. We have a mixed economy. It's not a pure capitalist or pure free market economy. So there's a range. And so I think you can look at different countries, and I don't know that you can just say this economic system fails. I think you'd have to look at it a case-by-case basis and see why it fails. Laura is right that some of it is U.S. Intervention to overthrow regimes or undermine regimes, but that hasn't always been the case. In some of our allies in NATO are pretty socialist in their economies,
right.
and some of them are do quite well.
Right, right. I lived in Europe for over a decade, and socialist was not a, quote, dirty word in Europe, nor is it today. And we've had many socialist governments in Western European countries we consider close allies or have in the past considered close allies. Let's also add to our conversation, Mike Zmolik is a lecturer and historian at the University of Iowa. Mike, welcome to our program.
Thank you. And I'd just like to make a quick shout out to my father, who recently celebrated his 91st birthday in Newton, Iowa, with his wife, Catherine, and my sister, Polly.
All right. Very good. Mike, back to our conversation. So tell us, what do you make of the historical context as a historian? Does it make sense what we're seeing today, this popularity, this resurgence?
Well, socialism, as our other guest had said, you know, is had a rough road in the United States. U.S. has been kind of the leading anti-communist country. You know, the Cold War was fighting a battle against the perceived threat of communism as a threat to the free market system. And this country was sort of capitalist out of the box. This country was formed by what we some of us call English agrarian capitalism. And it was based on the idea of, individual rights and free markets from the get-go. And so it's been a very long-standing tradition in the United States to embrace the idea that markets and self-help and hard work are, you know, the ethics that drive the economy forward, and those are all good things. And those have tended to be associated with capitalism, and there is a deep distrust, and there's a strong libertarian tradition in this country, something that the libertarians share with anarchists on the left side, of deep distrust of state power. And so when you try to set up in other countries a system where the state is regulating the economy, Americans have always kind of bristled at that idea. So that's one reason, and there's many others. We have to, you know, talk through the McCarthy era in the 1950s and so on, why socialism's had a rough go in this country. But we did have something called the New Deal, and I think what we haven't talked about in this conversation yet is the New Deal and the way in which the New Deal is sort of very slowly piecemeal being sort of dismantled. And we've had 40 or more years of wage stagnation in this country for workers. And it's not at all surprising to me that we're seeing a resurgence of the concept of socialism and a resurgent working class. When people like Laura sitting next to me are talking about how, you know, working for $8.26 an hour is just not enough to raise a family and get by.
And when we talk about the New Deal, now the New Deal comes in the middle of the 20th century after our Great Depression, and that is our biggest sort of pedestal of socialism in this country. Social Security comes in, and we say as a society, people will not age and age into poverty, right?
Right.
There's going to be a net.
Right. Absolutely. And you got something very similar across Western Europe in what was called social democracy. The one big missing piece in the United States, and it was the civil rights leader Mary McLeod Bethune, who working with FDR, said, you know, one of her big regret in working on the New Deal is that we didn't get a national health care system. And I think that's been at the center of all the debates, about our current political economic crisis, because we have, unlike Western Europe, unlike Canada, we don't have a national health care system. And so in the United States, if you're poor and you get sick, you suffer.
You led right up to what I want to play, a little bit of an archive from a well-known voice here, Mike. This is an early LP recording from 1961. Ronald Reagan, the title of the LP is Ronald Reagan Speaks Out Against Socialized Medicine. Was distributed in 1961, part of Operation Coffee Cup. It's a campaign conducted by the American Medical Association in opposition to the Democrats' plans to extend Social Security to health insurance for the elderly. Let's hear the reasoning against extending Social Security to health insurance for the elderly, as articulated in 1961 by Ronald Reagan.
Write those letters now. Call your friends and tell them to write them. If you don't, this program, I promise you, will pass just as surely as the sun will come up tomorrow. And behind it will come other federal programs that will invade every area of freedom as we have known it in this country. Until, one day, as Norman Thomas said, we will awake to find that we have socialism. And if you don't do this, and if I don't do it, one of these days, you and I are going to spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America, when men were free.
Okay, Mike, that is, you mentioned the McCarthy era.
Yep.
That is right in the right post-McCarthy era, but we're still feeling a fervent anti-communism in this country in 1961. Of course, the Cold War is right in the midst of that.
Well, a couple of names to bring into this conversation are John Maynard Keynes, who was the architect of the kind of economics that led to the New Deal and, to a large extent, social democracy in Western Europe. And his opponents in the economic sphere, Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, who were writing at the same time but were in the minority in the 1940s and 50s, and whose ideas have now, especially under Reagan, since Reagan, become the kind of framework of economic doctrine that we live in. And what they were arguing is that we have to get back to laissez-faire. We have to get back to the idea that markets know best and that is this kind of a good versus evil conception of markets as good and states as bad. And we've been living under that kind of doctrine for 40 years now, and we're seeing the effects. We're seeing enormous concentrations of wealth, and we're seeing a working class in the United States that is increasingly struggling as we roll back social safety net protections for workers in this country. Americans work, 6 days for every 5 days that Europeans work. And our healthcare system is, we pay twice as much.
If you've got good health insurance, it's really good.
Oh, it's a great system if you're rich. But if you're poor, we pay, more than twice as much as any other country for our healthcare system, and we're about 35th on the list of outcomes.
Okay. We're going to take a break in just a minute, but I want to sneak in a call. We have a lot of interest of people wanting to get in. We'll get as many callers as we can before the end of the hour. Karen is with us from Waterloo. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. And I guess my perspective or point of view is this, and that is that I don't like labels, but here, prior to the last election, I had embraced the Democratic Party because it was closest to my mindset with regard to morals and ideas. And I was definitely a fan and a follower of Bernie Sanders. And I felt as though the primaries were predetermined before numbers were actually ever counted. And I felt as though it was an outcome that was pre-planned by the Democratic Party, and that no amount of votes would sway the party to embrace Bernie Sanders. And I feel as though in that way, my voice was lost. And my response to that was to change my party affiliation to independent. And
would you call yourself a Democratic Socialist or a progressive? What do you choose?
I don't. I don't feel I have to choose. What I have to do is just find that mindset. I'm learning more about this listening to the program today, and for that reason, I appreciate it because I don't know enough about what those labels totally embrace to say, yeah, that's me. But because of your conversation today, I'm learning more about it. I am not a young person. I'll be 60 this year. And I have my own set of needs and concerns. And certainly Bernie Sanders addressed most of them. I just feel as though it isn't just millennials who are concerned about this.
Okay, we'll talk about.
And I'm not alone in my age group.
Okay, we know that. We'll talk about how the generations fit into this. Millennials, those are people born in the 80s and 90s who come of age the early 2000s, as opposed to the boomers. Millennials becoming the largest voting group. We'll come back as we discuss democratic socialism. Here's a little music that may remind you of the 2016 campaign. Bernie Sanders jumped on this favorite tune from Simon and Garfunkel to rekindle a sense of community, I guess you would say, some good feelings towards democratic socialism. He called himself a democratic socialist. That was really new when Bernie came out and did that. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, with Laura Rodriguez, Jeff Taylor, and Mike Smolnik. We'll be back in just a moment with more of River to River.
On the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a
spy. Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Talking about socialism, democratic socialism this hour. It used to be a slur, but now we know from, well, the Most recent case, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, this 28-year-old Democratic socialist, shook the Democratic Party, took down the number four incumbent in the House of Representatives, and he's got people talking about what democratic socialism is. More than any other generation before them, many millennials are okay with socialism. A 2016 Gallup poll found 55% of those aged 18 to 29, these are millennials, those born in the 80s and 90s, they had a positive view of socialism. And it's worth noting that majority supported capitalism and a large majority supporting free enterprise at the same time. Compare that with those 65 and older, only 24% had a positive view of socialism. Well, after candidate Hillary Clinton secured enough votes for the nomination in the June of 2016, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders delivered what sounded like a concession speech, though he technically did not concede the party's nomination or endorse Hillary Clinton. In his live stream speech, he laid out his vision for the U.S. government and encouraged his supporters to continue fighting.
We have begun the long and arduous process of transforming America, a fight that will continue tomorrow, next week, next year, and into the future. My hope is that when future historians look back and describe how our country moved forward into reversing the drift toward oligarchy, and how we move forward in creating a government which represents all of the people and not just the few, that they will note that to a significant degree, that effort began with the political revolution of 2016.
Bernie Sanders, June of 2016. Joining our conversation this hour, Jeff Taylor, professor of political science at Dort College in Sioux Center. Mike Smolik, he's a University of Iowa historian. Laura Rodriguez, Democratic Socialists of America chapter chair in Quad Cities. History. Bernie Sanders talking about starting a historical wave. Mike, do you think that was sort of the point of the spear, the beginning of the wave, whatever picture you want there?
Well, I think we have to go back to Reagan and Clinton to understand what's going on. Clinton is the first Democratic president to really break with the New Deal.
Bill Clinton.
And this comes in the aftermath of the Reagan administration, which really began the era of neoliberalism and this new policy of reviving laissez-faire and, you know, his slogan, getting big government off our backs and so forth. And the context for that is that you had a post-war boom of enormous proportions. Coming out of that, you know, period of the New Deal when tax rates rose as high as 90% on every dollar that businesses made over $100,000. So you had businesses at the end of that boom facing massively declining profit rates, really freaking out. So what did they do? They said, well, you know, we got to cut costs. Where are we going to cut costs? Well, we pay our workers too much. Look at workers in other parts of the world. They are paid much less. And more than that, we can now start outsourcing jobs to those countries. We can start relocating and having our manufacturing base in China or Mexico and pay workers far less than American workers are paid. So U.S. workers now are suddenly in competition with workers all around the world who are getting paid much lower wages, while Reagan's administration has put in laws that make it virtually illegal to be a union organizer. So we went from being a country where you had strikes quite often in this country to a country that has very few strikes, and union membership dropped from 35% to less than 10%. Mm-hmm. So Bill Clinton comes in and he says, well, you know, in his campaign, they have to figure out a way to win in this new environment when unions no longer have the big war chest to support party politicians. And so they make a turn to the business community and make a pitch, you know, fund our campaigns. And so we got a Democratic Party that now looks very much like the Republican Party in the way it pursues big business funding instead of, you know, relying so much on working class.
And some of the electorate then feeling abandoned by the Democratic Party.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's part of the rise of Democratic Socialism.
Yeah. And in many ways, then Bernie Sanders is essentially trying to say, well, let's get back to the New Deal. Let's get back to a labor-based party, which is a very hard thing to do. But given the conditions, you know, the effects of these policies for the last 40 years, you can see that there's a massive response to what he's calling for.
join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We'll go back to the phones in just a minute. We want to talk also with Lisa Lai. We're talking with Democratic Socialists this hour as well as, in that case, UI historian Mike Smolnik and Jeff Taylor, our political scientists for this hour. Lisa Lai is co-founder and treasurer of Heart of Iowa Democratic Socialists of America, co-founded this chapter about a year ago, I understand. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you cover what counties in Iowa?
Boone, Story, Marshall, Hardin, and Hamilton.
Okay, tell us a little bit about yourself. Why did you start with the Democratic Socialists of America and start this chapter in the heart of Iowa?
Sure. Well, I also am the daughter of immigrants, and I grew up seeing firsthand all the different ways that I was disadvantaged because of being poor, because of being a minority, and being an immigrant. And I grew up on food stamps and Medicaid, arguably socialist programs. So I'm a living testament to how working class people can be elevated when we collectively decide to invest in the dignity and humanity of all people. And I started this chapter because in Ames here, we have a lot of political organizations, but when I moved here, there really wasn't an explicitly anti-capitalist org. And so I wanted to start that to give a voice to a more radical kind of politics that I felt like was needed.
Anti-capitalist. In what way are you anti-capitalist?
Well, we believe in giving power back to workers under a capitalist system. Currently, I think it's the top 1% owns 50% of the wealth. Mm-hmm. In our economy. And while we have democracy in our political realm, we want to give that democracy in our workplaces and in the economy as well. So I believe that we should be able to decide how the wealth and resources in our economy are distributed.
Lisa, tell me a little bit about your group. You founded it about a year ago. How many members do you have?
We have about 30 members and growing. And
you finding any trouble recruiting or just people coming out and saying, I want to do this?
No, it's been really great. We've had a really great response.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your members. Are there common themes, common experiences? You described a little bit of yours. Do you find themes in your group when you get to know your members?
Yeah, absolutely. Most people can describe, as Laura did earlier very eloquently, like what personal experiences they've had that brought them into socialism. A lot of it has to do with feeling disadvantaged and powerless as a regular person.
Mm-hmm. Let me put to you a bit of criticism of socialism from Jay and Adele. He just emailed us, and he writes, most socialist societies fail because production decreases. If everything is shared equally, people are not as motivated to produce. The result is either failure or an authoritarian government. Those whose production decreases are punished. So we'll get a number of responses here. But to you, Lisa, how do you deal with that sort of criticism? If everybody's equal, I mean, what drives our machine is that you can work as an individual. You're socially mobile. You can make something of yourself. If you just say flatten out everything in terms of rewards, what's going to drive society?
Well, I would say what should drive society is what I like to call radical compassion, where we recognize that one person's well-being is dependent on the well-being of everyone else. Mm-hmm. And so if we have that kind of an understanding and community in our society, we won't have that problem.
Right. Hey, Jeff, weigh in on this comment from Jay and Adele in his email there that socialism fails because it doesn't have the incentives that our form of capitalism has.
Well, I think, there's a couple things going on there. When he's talking about productivity, partly I think the dominant capitalist sector in the United States for decades now has put a great emphasis on economic growth. Is the GNP, is the GDP increasing, and at what rate? But one of the problems with that is that not everybody benefits, not just equally, but even proportionately with that system. If it is a type of capitalism that's rigged in the sense that the economic and the political sectors are working together, the crony capitalism model. If that's what's really going on, then, as Mike points out, you get a situation where the economy is booming in theory, if you look at the numbers of productivity, but the wages of working class or just middle class in general, they've been stagnant since the 1960s. And so people look at that, and it becomes a question not just of equality, but even justice or fairness. And so I don't know that productivity is necessarily the end-all, be-all of what kind of a successful society you have. But I would say that I agree with his point that it can undercut the motivation if the feeling is the government is taking care of all, regardless of how much they put into the economy or how much individual initiative they provide. I mean, that is one of the potential weaknesses of socialism. It can undercut the motivation for the individual to try to work hard to get ahead.
Lisa Lai, let me ask you. You founded your chapter of Democratic Socialists of America about a year ago. Not a coincidence that about a year ago we've had about a half year of this president. What does your founding have to do with Donald Trump's ascendancy to the White House?
Well, we have had an incredible amount of growth, I think, in reaction to Donald Trump. Our national organization, Democratic Socialists of America, is now at 40,000 members nationwide. And 2 years ago, it was around 5,000. So mm-hmm. It's been a huge growth.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our phones. Scott joining us from Clinton, 1-866-780-9100. Scott, coming up to the end of the hour, I'll ask you to be brief, but welcome to our program from Clinton.
Thank you. Hey, so a couple of the things being discussed here are universal secondary education and universal health care. My question is, what kind of studies have been done to analyze those two things and see what the net change would be on a per citizen basis? So if we were to implement these policies and then make them basically taxpayer funded, what portion of that funding would come to me? What would my tax dollar change be from year to year?
Response from one of our Democratic Socialists, Laura or Lisa? Okay.
Well,
Lisa?
I'm sorry. It's just Lisa, take this one.
I don't know. I don't have the numbers, but I could say that the military is the largest part of our budget, and if we just used a fraction of that to put into some of these universal programs, again, investing in people, as many, many other industrialized nations do, you know, it's been done before.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mike, weigh in on this.
So if you look at tax rates in France and tax rates in the United States, France has, you know, the best healthcare system in the world. And you're looking at about 30% tax rate, 32%. And the United States is about 30%. Where does our money go? Our money goes, you know, about 50% of our taxes go to the military and not too much to our healthcare system. Obamacare was sort of a half measure to sort of fix this. It hasn't worked very well, in my opinion. I'm a supporter of single payer. I think it's the only way to go, and I think we have a proven track record that it works in Western Europe, and we can simply follow that model. You know, part of it is a moral question. Part of the moral question is, you know, when we had going into Obamacare something like 40,000 people a year dying because they don't have healthcare in this country, and four million people without health care, you know, there's a moral question to, you know, why we can't provide health care to people who can't afford it in this country. But in terms of your question about what it would look like in your tax rate, I mean, where's the pushback on Obamacare been? It's been from the very wealthy who don't want to have to foot the bill for this extra health care. And, you know, going back to the New Deal, you know, it was Roosevelt's idea that where are we going to get the money to get out of the Depression? We're going to have to tax the rich. That's what Bernie Sanders is saying. We're going to have to tax the rich. So unless you're very, very wealthy, I don't see your tax burden going up a great deal. But it will go up some, especially if we continue to have this huge military budget.
Right. But you have to get the levers of political power first, which the Democratic Socialists are far from having at this point. Laura.
Let's talk about taxing the rich. I mean, how little do they really contribute and how much do they exploit their workers and the communities in which they operate. It's just, it blows me away when people will defend that, you know, the tax incentives and all the low tax rates for the very rich and their corporations. Well, how can one man contribute 1 billion times more than his worker? You know what I mean? Like when somebody is a billionaire, whose work was it that made him that billionaire? And what resources did he use that were public to operate his business? You need to look at that and analyze it before asking that question. I'm sorry.
No. Jeff Taylor, let's shift a little bit into the final 5 minutes of our program. Jeff Taylor, let's talk a little bit about how the Democratic Party is dealing with democratic socialism, the rise of the progressive wing, and even further to the left than that. What do you see happening here in 2018, 2020, and beyond, Jeff?
Well, I think it was maybe Lisa that was talking about kind of the perception that the Democratic Party primary system was rigged in 2016, even before Bernie Sanders got out of the gate. And I agree with that analysis. The party leadership, the establishment, the superdelegates, they certainly were in Clinton's camp. And the irony is that Sanders himself polled better against Trump throughout that primary season than Clinton did. And I think in the end, Sanders probably would have had a better chance of beating Trump than Clinton. But in the end, I think we'd also say that the party leadership, I think in their heart of hearts, they would rather lose with a Clinton as the nominee than win with somebody like Sanders as a nominee, because he does really represent a challenge in foreign policy, economic policy, political reform policy, all of these areas. He really does represent, as he describes it, as a revolution, not just within the country, but within the Democratic Party. So I think there's going to be continued resistance to this. You saw a little bit of this of the dismissive attitude that Nancy Pelosi had toward the Ocasio-Cortez win in the primary, that this was a specific thing in a specific district. She didn't really see this as something that was going to change the party or be a ripple effect of some kind of revolution.
Mike, let me put this to you. I've seen parallels, historical parallels with the Tea Party here, summoned to mind. Does this turmoil within the Democratic Party mirror what was Republican turmoil in the first 2 years of the Barack Obama administration? Democrats controlling the levers of government, the birth of the Tea Party, and then at first the sort of impotent protest, which eventually turned into political power.
Well, the timing of all these events, I think, have a lot to do with what happened in 2007 and 2008 with what we now call the Great Recession. And what we saw in Europe was a polarizing between left and right in parties, which is continuing. And I think that's what we've been seeing in the United States. And so the 2016 election, you got Bernie Sanders moving, trying to move the Democratic Party further to the left and Trump taking it further to the right. And that tends to happen in a period of crisis.
Lisa Lai, before we run out of time, I want to hear some local issues that you are interested in as a Democratic Socialist here in Iowa in your group of 30 or 40.
Yeah, absolutely. So my chapter started a tenants union for renters. And a success story is recently we got one renter's security deposit back to her from a landlord that was withholding it unjustly. We're also working with a group to get municipal internet here in Ames, and we have also been working on migrant justice issues with the SF 481 bill that passed at the state legislature.
Mm-hmm. Laura Rodriguez, our other Democratic Socialist in our conversation from the Quad Cities, what do you see as local issues there that you're working on and most concerned about?
Oh boy, we've got our hands full in the Quad Cities, I will say, like anywhere else. One of the issues from last year was gentrification. There's a Palmer Chiropractic School that is basically trying to price everybody out of the neighborhood who already lives there to buy up the land, get the schools closed, let the properties go to blight so that they can snatch it all up. So we have, in response to that, gone to, you know, city hall meetings and done some canvassing work. That was one issue. We're trying to get our housing labor group to, or our housing working group together to start a tenants union. We are trying to get a worker center off the ground. We have a lot of really great people that care a whole lot that are working on these issues, and I just wanted to praise them publicly right now. I love the Quad Cities, and I love all the great work from our chapter.
Mm-hmm. Far too much input to get to entirely this hour, but David in Iowa City emailing, please take note that socialism is not communism. Socialism does not take away incentive. Jeff Taylor, at a certain time, boomers equate socialism and communism, don't they?
Yes.
To some degree.
Right. Communists are socialists, but not all socialists are communists. So it's socialism is a broader term than that, although I do think, to me, communism, the essence there is that totalitarian system in terms of governance. But I do think there are some issues of incentive, even with a democratic type of socialist government, because it's still the government kind of acting as the arbiter and as sort of the provider. So I think there's still some issues there.
Okay. We've run out of time. Jeff Taylor of Dort College in Sioux Center, Mike Smolnik of the University of Iowa, Laura Rodriguez, and Lisa Lai of the Democratic Socialists of America. Laura, Lisa, Mike, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It went by quickly. We'll have to continue this conversation and see how your movement develops.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And thanks to our callers.
Hi,
our callers.
Hi, Dad.
And emailers this hour. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. Help from Jason Burns as well today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.